You're listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real-life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
So here we go. See, Nisheen, you have asked the question that I love people asking, which is, so how does the interview work? Well, it's just like this. It's completely unprepared. It's spontaneous. No planning whatsoever.
Okay.
And that can either lead to
disaster.
That's right. Yes. So fools leap in where angels fear to tread. But all is well, because I have two things that are really important. A, a cup of coffee, and B, most important, a fabulous guest.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. I fear that I'm not very funny, and your British humor is just going to be like phenomenal.
Don't worry, because as I say frequently, I like to set myself low standards and consistently fail to achieve them. No one is listening to this, so we're absolutely fine. We can say whatever we want. We don't have to worry about anyone complaining. But yes, I'll run out of humor and talent very quickly. Don't worry.
That's terrific.
Unlike you, who have invented the cure for something incredible with your company, January.ai, which is in itself a fabulous name, which, deserves no introduction. But I have an introduction here. But I mean, I hate reading these introductions because they're so sort of, you've created this phenomenal healthcare company. And in addition to that, you manage trillions of dollars for a family office, where you have exposure to all sorts of other, great technologies and startups. So your background is not just entrepreneurial. You see it from both sides of the coin. You see it from the investor side, which is a very difficult thing to be. But you also see it from the operator side. Isn't that cheating slightly?
Not really. I think, I was an operator at Oracle for 10 years and then went to operate another company mid-90s, early days of .com, personal
finance. Mid-90s. There was no .com then. It was AOL. It was like, your email address was 755-97644 at CompuServe.com.
Indeed. It was kind of crazy. But personal finance was just happening. Like people used to go to Charles Schwab and to execute a trade, or they would call their stockbroker on the telephone. They would read the paper and look up stock prices on the back of a newspaper on a day-to-day basis. So we were doing something really innovative, which was bringing essentially financial data online for personal investors. And the whole world of personal investing was beginning to develop. And so tools prior to that company had been in the hands of companies like Bloomberg. So investors had professional quote unquote terminals.
Well, I was a stockbroker at that time. So we had our Bloomberg.
There you go.
You had Reuters and Bloomberg. Everyone preferred Bloomberg because it was, it had much more stuff to do.
Exactly. And we could talk 10 minutes on Bloomberg because what an incredible story. They really stayed with the times. They never became irrelevant, which is really interesting. Even though the technology changed and the whole, so many things changed in terms of how people trade and how people, transact. But so I was doing that in the mid-90s, and we sold that company. And then I went off to the family office, and two kids and two foundations later, I decided to go back to the dark side and began operating some of our portfolio companies around 2013. And about 4 years later, decided that I really wanted to be an operator. I wanted to bet on myself. I was helping other entrepreneurs, and I was coaching, and those companies were really interesting and they were doing really interesting work. But I think the ultimate bet is to bet on yourself. And so I started January, and the name came from, obviously, January is the month of new beginnings. It's based on Greek god Janus, who has two faces, if you've looked at that before. But we think of the look back as kind of the cards you were dealt in life, the genetics that you were given, the food that you were raised with, the habits that you were cultivated for you, with your family or how you were raised. And then you face forward, a person of reason deciding how to live the rest of your life. And my my son was 16 years old when he came up with the name. We brainstormed like 300-400 names. And the second he said January, it just was, I was looking for something like Amazon and Apple, and he said January. And I was like, it's a real name. It's not a weird name. Like 3-5-A triple
D. You don't spell it with three N's or something as well.
No, exactly. Don't do it. Just have it be a regular name. But generally people think of January as, you know, a time of renewal, a time of resolutions. And so we wanted people to feel like every day, you know, that we are all on a journey. We do plan and make goals, but we do get derailed, and it's okay to get back on. And in a way, every day can be January 1st.
So did you find coming from the investor side? So to start out, you were very much an operator. You were involved with this very exciting landscape, which was the early days of the internet, which was actually very difficult to navigate because we didn't have any, you had no bandwidth, we had no broadband. And again, I think Oracle itself was still very much in its infancy. So, you know, the very platforms that you could build things on didn't exist. And I know that there were some tremendous exits in the sort of late 90s. And did you find it difficult moving from being an operator or from being an entrepreneur
to an investor?
No,
because every investment needs operating help. Every investment needs...
I mean, psychologically, though, I mean, because as an investor, because I presume that most of your investments would be minority investments.
Yes, minority investments. Also, the investments are in public companies, they're in private companies, they're in limited partnerships in VC funds, they're in a variety of funds of different kinds. So it's quite a diverse portfolio. But of course, the whole idea of a diverse portfolio is a new concept. When you generally people, you know, earn their wealth in a single instrument, in a single stock. And then they have to learn the whole game of diversity, which is very counterintuitive. And my husband and I refused to sell Oracle shares because he worked at Oracle for 10 years as well. And then he went to Yahoo and he was founding CTO of Yahoo for 11 years. So he also had Yahoo shares, and neither one of us were interested in selling any of it.
Looking back, that was probably the right decision, I would have thought.
It was right and wrong, but we thought it was sacrilegious. We thought it was disloyal. We just didn't understand how you actually develop wealth after you have earned it, you know, what you do with it next. And so this idea of, you know, people... So anyway, we can go into that. But in terms of a mindset, it is a different mindset to invest. And that's one of the reasons I still invest. I just invested in a company yesterday. I invested in two other companies in the last 6 months. I still do invest. But I think my approach to investing was hands-on. So invest and then get in and help people, you know, show up and interview for them, do a number of things, jump in if necessary on the board, hire a CEO, hire executives. But my husband's approach is very different. So of the 130 companies that we've invested in, he's invested in 100 of them. I've invested in 30 of them. And his approach is a more of a portfolio approach. You know, people call him when they need him, but he generally doesn't get operationally involved. So he's taken a portfolio approach and he's done phenomenally well, phenomenally well, because the rule of the numbers really does work. When you invest in 100, it is possible that one or two make it really, really big. I've had unicorns of my own, thankfully, in the 30 that I've invested in, but mine was more hands-on. So I decided, hey, if I'm going to be hands-on in a company, then I'm going to jump in and start my own company. These days, my role is very hands-off. So the three companies I just invested in, I'm not spending any time whatsoever with them. So now my singular focus is January. That is my biggest investment. And I am in that investment 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. So
is it creativity that you think drives this sort of, is it a need, or is it that you feel that one sort of comes with investing, there is a limited amount of change that you can make if you're not there as the CEO on a day-to-day basis?
That's absolutely true. I have gone into companies.
God, I thought you were going to say that's absolute rubbish. Sorry.
No, it's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. No, I went in, some of my friends, to both partners I'm friends with, of the very, very successful Silicon Valley VC company, very, very, very successful. They asked me to come in and look at their companies. I looked at 9 companies. I spent half an hour each with the CEO. And I wrote a SWOT analysis for each one of the companies. Yeah. And I presented it to them and they would just shake their head. And like, as I went through, they would just go, oh my God, it's so true. It's so true. It's so true. And then they would say like I had basically read the company in 30 minutes with the CEO. I had the whole thing about their entire market, what was going on, what, whether they were. So they were like, yes, it's true, but we can't tell them. Like we've told them that. We've told the CEO that. We've told them this. Yeah. We've told them this, but he won't listen. He won't, you know. And so I think there needs to be patience. I think the entrepreneurs need to be respected and really given the space to come to those conclusions themselves, even though the answer is clear as day. And the investors, successful investors, have a way of managing sort of how they give feedback and how they receive feedback and how they have this great exchange with their entrepreneurs in terms of, you know, having the sense of urgency, but also allowing these entrepreneurs to operate in the way that they know best. So it's a tricky game, that's for sure. And yes. I must say, one of the companies that was just as clear as day when I walked in and said, geez, they have a whole data play and they had a piece of hardware and they were collecting data. I don't want to tell you which company it was, but they were collecting data and selling the data and they were doing $10 million deals. So of course, when you're successful, you never think you should do things differently. You should do things better. And I was like, no, there's a data play above the data because you hand governments data. What are they going to do with the data? You need to analyze, say that it means this.
Yes.
So they eventually did get into the data play. But at the time, the CEO was just so focused on building the hardware. He was so proud of the hardware they had built that, you know, he kept showing you that. And then they just went public, actually. So he did get onto the data play. And it just didn't happen in that time frame, you know, when I was talking to him back, you know, 6 years ago. So I think there's a whole lot of patience that is required if you're sitting in the investor seat.
But also, I think as an investor, you bring something vital, which is perspective, which, as you were saying, you could sit, listen to a CEO for half an hour. It just rings so many bells that you can sort of map out, you know, the likelihood. So it's great. Tell me a bit about January AI.
Right. Let me just say one more thing on the investment. So I think if you've been an operator and you've done a lot of operations, you basically have great pattern recognition. So even if there is, you know, little time that you spent with the entrepreneur, you can quickly figure out kind of where they are with things. And so you can help them very quickly. But thank you for asking about January AI. Really appreciate it. What aspect of it would you like me to talk about?
Well, just really, because it's quite a complex, you know, behind the scenes, you know, it's a complex, you know, sort of offering, as it were. So what really attracted you to January? Was it a portfolio company that suddenly you felt very passionate about? Or
yeah, it's interesting that you say it. So January, I founded it from scratch, from a clean sheet of paper, from the very, very beginning. And when I decided to start a company, I actually did a very thorough, methodical search, very, very, very thorough. I looked at everything that was happening in the world, all the meta trends, everything else. And I really wanted a company that I could scale because I think I have a gift for scaling. And I wanted to, I had gone into Oracle, not from day one, but from about $25 million in revenues. And we had done a tremendous job scaling that company from $25 million to $3 billion in revenues. So I knew how that felt and how that felt in my bones and in my blood. And I wanted to do that again and feel that adrenaline again. So first I looked for companies to buy, actually. And after looking at two or three companies in the health world, and I became convinced very quickly I wanted to work in health and I wanted to work in machine learning. There are stories about that. Maybe I could share that with you some other time. So after not finding the companies I wanted to buy, the two I happened to be looking at had both been started by doctors, and they were kind of still run like medical offices, which I didn't think was the best model of running a company.
Yeah.
So being passionate about prevention and multiomics and the whole person health and essentially eradicating lifestyle-based chronic diseases, I thought, okay, I'm going to have to start this myself. And then I met Mike Snyder, who also was passionate about all of those things. And we quickly, it just literally, it was so organic. It was crazy how it all came together. And we quickly coalesced around the idea of using wearables to help people figure out what was happening in their bodies and really get to know themselves really, really well. And so that's kind of how we started that company. So it was started from a clean sheet of paper with the vision that, you know, it would be multi-omic, it would be whole person, that wearables would play a big role in terms of one omic, but so would other omics, that, you know, so much had been, you know, there was so much hoopla about genetics, and that's one piece of the puzzle.
The problem that you're solving, if I can summarize it, is it's sugar, basically. Is that a one way of looking at it? People, the overconsumption of sugar, the education or lack of education about the impact of sugar. So on one side, you've got something that appears to be the root of all problems, whether it's, you know, high fructose corn syrup or other forms of sugar and how they're involved. But what when you started this, it's a health problem, but it's also a big pharma problem. It's a food problem. It's an industrial disease. So
100, yeah.
You know, you're sort of, you have several tigers by the tail, I would have thought.
Yes. So I've heard people say, you know, if big pharma and big food could come up with the perfect disease, it'd be diabetes. But, you know, I like to be kinder than that. It is, you know, why we have ended up here definitely has a lot to do with the kind of food we eat. That's 100% the case. It also has to do with the fact that after invention of television, we became much less mobile. And, you know, we were not meant to sit all day long. We were not meant to, you know, we weren't even meant to sit all day long and then just work out at the gym an hour. We were out and about until about, you know, 10,000 years ago, before, you know, when agriculture essentially produced so much surpluses for us that we could afford to like sit down and sort of hang out and have more kids and everything else. Before that, we were running around and we were hunter-gatherers and we were eating 150 grams of fiber a day, which kept us very actually healthy. And we weren't dying of the same kinds of diseases as we are now. So there are several things happening. We are not mobile as we were foundationally. We are eating packaged foods, which have a lot of harmful products in them. They lack fiber in a dramatic way. So our diet lacks fiber in a substantial way. Fiber is critical to health. One of my colleagues before used to say 80% of health was fiber and the rest is January, which is like dialing the rest of the levers. So fiber is really foundational to health. And I think packaged foods, yes, up until now, people have really been able to market foods just without any consequence, you know? And some of these foods, as you know very well, if you talk about big food and Bliss Point, these foods are meant to be addictive. Yeah. So they literally...
They're engineered, aren't they?
They're engineered with just the right...
Phrases like mouthfeel and, you know...
That's right. So they're engineered to have just the right amount of salt, fat, and sugar for you to keep wanting to eat them and just not feeling satisfied, not feeling satiated and just wanting... I personally have gone through boxes of white cheddar Cheez-Its before I knew this. Before I knew anything about Bliss Point, I just thought, I love Cheez-Its. This is delicious. So just go through one box of white cheddar Cheez-Its just like that. So yeah, so there are many, many factors and the consequences are huge. And obesity is still rising in every country in the world. And so we have a global problem on our hands. And the solution, yes, on a personal basis, people can watch their own blood sugar. But I think on a structural basis, you know, in terms of what governments can do and what companies can do, what nonprofits can do, what everybody can do, I think there is a lot that needs to be done that goes beyond the role of the individual. But certainly the individual must take self-advocate. They must get to know their own bodies. I mean, who's going to care more than you are? Who knows you better than yourself? So our company helps people learn about themselves, makes it easy for people to see what's happening in their body, to see inside their body, to see how their blood sugar is going up and down as they take different actions, and to be able to react to those. And we also help you with our tools. So we help you learn how to eat more fiber by telling you how much fiber you're already eating. We help you manage your calories by looking at how active you are. And we help you eat lower glycemic index foods. So if we see big spikers, let's say there are three foods that are really spiking Matthew's blood sugar in a big way. Okay, we let you know what those three biggest spikers are, and then we show you alternatives for those foods. Or we show you either food alternatives or we show you activity alternatives, what we call activity counterfactuals. That's not a very consumer term. We're still working on our terminology. We are a bunch of geeky people with a lot of big words that we're trying to
make
more accessible.
Is a great word, which I shall adopt and use as my own henceforth.
Yes, exactly. But the activity counterfactual is like, if you ate this,
it's otherwise known as a lie.
Not that kind of counterfactual, but it's like if you ate, let's say, you know, fish and chips and you spiked X amount, let's say your blood sugar went to 150. If you walked 10 minutes right after, what would your blood sugar be at? If you walked 25 minutes right after, what your blood sugar would come at? And that's what the AI does, which is very, very cool. The AI actually gives you tools to see, oh, I can still eat fish and chips, but I need to walk X amount. Do I have time to walk X amount? I don't. Okay, I'm going to eat it on a day that I can. So we're all about not depriving you, not like saying, oh, don't eat this. Stop doing that. Because that's what people are getting right now. They get diagnosed with diabetes and their doctor says, everything you were doing until yesterday is wrong. Drop 50 pounds and, you know, don't eat, you know, refined sugar, refined flour, eat a lot of vegetables and walk 10,000 steps a day. And that's just daunting for most people. So we give them small steps. We give them really,
Sorry to interrupt, but you see, so by biting off or by attacking this huge problem, the payoff potentially is enormous because it is a global marketplace, mm-hmm. and it is a significant, you know, human problem that goes, you know, it's multi-generational.
Absolutely. And the complications from diabetes are horrendous, you know, involving nerve damage, organ damage, like kidney damage. You know, there's, you know, diabetes-based kidney disease. There's, you know, fatty liver. There's like cardiovascular disease. There is, you know, problems with eyesight, amputation. You know, problems are quite big.
Know that you don't get those problems with fish and chips, incidentally. So carry on, you know, support the fish and your local fish and chip because it's.
January, find a recipe for fish and chips that's low glycemic index.
I don't have to walk, you know, where someone else can walk and I can. But the other problem, though, is when we talk about as an investor, you're always looking at total addressable market and, you know, mm-hmm. the Tam Sam Song thing. So how do you approach this problem? Because, you know, you cannot be all things to all people. So, you know, what is your angle or how did you come up with a solution where you can begin to get traction in an area that is perhaps where there's less competition? Or did you go through that same process to say, okay, this is the problem, this is how we're going to solve it, but this is how we're going to approach this so that we can build a bridgehead and then start expanding from within?
Well, day one, we started with our obsession with prediabetes. That was our obsession because we thought, Jesus, at that time, 90 million people had prediabetes. Some of them have since converted to diabetes. So there are 88 million people that have diabetes and prediabetes. Yeah. And of those people, you know, 84% of them don't even know they have it. And so, you know, talk about a time bomb. So research has shown that 58% of people with prediabetes, if they don't go through an intervention, could end up with diabetes. And so that was our obsession when we first started. We said, what a no-brainer. Let's see if people with prediabetes have glycemic dysregulation. Let's see if their blood sugar is going up and down a lot and going up, you know, more than what's normal, and how just to help them avoid foods that are spiking them.
How does machine learning play a role in this? Because I can see that at the bigger end, we're back to that sort of data and information discussion, because if you're collecting enough data from enough participants, mm-hmm. then there are many layers to the play here. It's not just at a consumer level, it's at a behavioral level.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what we did, basically, we started looking at wearables data, which Mike Snyder, my co-founder, had been wearing many, many wearables for many years. And he has some famous studies he's done called IPOP studies. He's done many studies. He did the Human Microbiome Project. He's not just a genomics guy. He's also, he's truly one of the world's few multi-omics scientists who looks at different omics, different parts of health, and kind of puts together the whole picture and then watches people go from health to disease and observing what's involved in that and using wearables in the process. So yeah, so when we first started, we started looking at prediabetes and we said, great, we'll start with wearables and see what that tells us. And quickly learned that food was a critical thing that we needed to know about. We needed to know what people are actually eating. We also set out not to just go, oh, this is a cool CGM. Great, let's just throw a CGM on everybody. It was more like, what's the benefit here? What's really the benefit and who really benefits? And obviously people with diabetes benefit, and let's see how we can benefit them. So we quickly looked at the data on food and noticed that data is extremely noisy. It lacks integrity. Like even like MyFitnessPal was collecting a lot of food data. It was crowdsourced. It was really hard to machine learn on that. USDA data wasn't really accurate. It was off by 20%. We noticed there were lots of curated databases, but they weren't all labeled. Like all the foods in Yelp, you know, they don't have labels. You can't go to your local mom and pop shop and see how much calories your salmon has, or, you know, your French fries or whatever you care about. So we realized we needed to label foods in order to be able to actually make food into an assay. If we wanted to be precise about food, we need to label food. So we began that, you know, massive project of aggregating a food database and then labeling the foods that weren't labeled. And then, which sounds way easier than it actually was. And then we saw that essentially the people's glycemic response were better associated with glycemic index and glycemic load of foods as opposed to just carbs. So a lot of predictions in the diabetes world up to now are this calculus of carbs to insulin, basically.
Over what period of time when did you start this program?
We hired our first technical person in November of 2017. Okay. And then in August of 2018, we were doing experiments all first 6 months of 2018. We were doing experiments on ourselves. We would do the craziest things. We would, you know, eat muesli and then eat it with guar gum to see what guar did, you know, what the impact of fiber was. Because fiber, you know, is big for glycemic response. If you have fiber in your stomach in the last 24 hours, it does lower your blood sugar in terms of what you will eat next. Activity. So we were looking at everything that affected your blood sugar going up and down, everything from stress to, you know, fiber.
I think was most astonishing for me really is not so much astonishing, but the thing that would worry me most is that you had to start not just, you couldn't build your business on the foundation of data that was reliable.
No, it's this cold start problem. Total cold start.
I mean, and the cold start actually was all the way back to food itself. So what you were saying is all the food labeling that you get is wrong.
Yes, there was the food labeling you get. First of all, there are no food labels. The food labels that exist could be wrong, even from USDA. And crowdsourced data wasn't useful because we looked at it and we were like, great, what
available data? That again is based on information that's secondhand. So
absolutely, absolutely.
Have you built your own, effectively, your own IPR, which is the real impact of certain foods? So even though you could say, if I go shopping and look at the label, it says carbs, X amount of grams, sugar, salt, I can disregard that if I go to your database and say, what's the truth?
You can definitely look at your personalized glycemic response to that food. Yes. Because especially if you're at the grocery store, and especially if it's got a food label, we would have ingested that into our database and we would have put our machine learning on it. And we would essentially, so what we do is this is how it works. You come in, you go through telemedicine, you get your, if you can benefit from CGMs, you get CGMs, you come download our app, you hook up your fitness tracker. I'm wearing an Apple Watch, a fitness tracker, like a Fitbit or Apple Watch, and your continuous glucose monitor to the app. And then you start logging your food for a period of 4 days and you just go about your life the way you normally would. So that's the period of time where we're collecting baseline data on you the first 4 days. And then after 4 days, we can start predicting your glycemic response. Boom. Even if you don't do any experiments or you don't do anything else, we can actually predict your glycemic response at that point. At that point, you can eat anything from our database, anything at all, or not eat it. Just look up anything in our database and we would already have your glycemic response to that thing at that point after 4 days.
But the most important thing there is we're talking about predictive as opposed to reactive information.
Absolutely. So this is one of the reasons we exist. There are many reasons we exist, but the main reason is, why should you use your body to try out the food? Why should you actually put the... So there are people who say, oh, I can't drink Chardonnay because I've been told by my doctor it has a lot of sugar. Turns out you can drink maybe a glass of Chardonnay and maybe not three glasses of Chardonnay. And a lot of people will tell you, I don't need the AI to tell me that. I just know that I can have that in moderation. Actually, you do, because you don't even know if that one single glass might spike you. And there are people, we've had people who don't spike on, who takes three glasses of Chardonnay to spike them versus just one glass of Chardonnay. So it is important to know, because there's a huge amount of guilt around food. There's a huge amount of deprivation and guilt and don't touch this and don't eat that and don't do this and don't do that. So I think it's important to be able to say, hey, I could have half a glass of this. I can't have a bite of that. I can't eat this. I can't eat that. And it is a little bit of difference with moderation, because personally, it has made a huge impact in my own journey. I was a hot chocolate connoisseur. I've been a foodie since I was a child, like literally have been pursuing food since I was, I was eating the whole family's like cream puffs when I was five, you know, before it was dessert time, and they would go to serve dessert and all the cream puffs would be gone. Like one time I ate 3 kilograms of cream puffs. I think I was 9. So
it's actually a world record, isn't it?
Yeah, it must be. I should be given an award for that. It's not how my mom saw it. So I think it is really different from person to person. And I think it's really important to know how it works, you know, for you.
There are some studies, or there are some approaches where people look at different blood types. So you can narrow down your chemistry to type A, B, C, or D or something. But what you're doing is you're actually looking at each person as an individual, looking at their personal chemistry based on information that is reliable. So the next stage then is the...
But you can't change your blood. So eating by blood type, I mean, whatever your blood type is, it is what it is. So just see what your body's doing. Just take a look at the reaction of what your body's doing, and then say, I want to eat this, or I want to eat that. Just look that up.
This gives you that information.
That gives you that information. Yeah.
I don't know if my blood sugar is spiking. I know, you can't tell. I mean, you can assume that you know, but you're getting false data or false signals, or you're interpreting the way that you feel potentially incorrectly. So, but this is very exciting from your perspective, because this touches on all of the things presumably that you looked at before, because if you get this right and you get mass adoption, which is a critical component, then, you know, you have all sorts of information and data, predictive analysis, and the ability to steer people along certain, you know, food choices.
Absolutely. Before we go to mass adoption, let me just talk about the technology a little bit more. So the technology, once we labeled the foods and did all that, then we ran a clinical trial that took a year and a half. So we then had to deal with the cold start problem, right? So we recruited, and 23,000 people showed up at the door. We took 1,022 of them, including 250 people with type 2 diabetes, and ran a trial where we put them on a program and watched their glycemic response to the foods they were eating. And based on what we learned with those 1,022 people, developed our algorithms, our prediction model of, this is how. So that's what we presented at the American Diabetes Association meeting academic sessions in 2020. And that prediction model is the core of our technology, where we can predict for you. Hence, if you eat this, we can then predict your response to 16 million other foods, which has the results that you mentioned, which is we're able to compare any two foods, any two groceries, any two recipes. We're able to tell you what the price of a food is in minutes of walking. We can get you to eat lower glycemic load foods. We can, you know, hack their food. We can get you to eat more fiber. We can get you to manage your calories. We can get you to learn how to fast. And then we know for a fact that intermittent fasting and calorie restriction together can have positive benefits for improving insulin sensitivity. So you're also working on your underlying physiology. So now back to, how do you get mass adoption? I think that's all about user experience. I think, you know, user experience is definitely what is going to create mass adoption. That's fact.
And do you get pushback? Are you seeing, you know, sort of competition, which isn't really competition? So the establishment, the status quo, are you, because you're doing something that is so revolutionary,
No, I would say that I wouldn't say we're getting a pushback that way. Well, there's definitely pushback. There are elements of the ecosystem that are not friendly to the foundational philosophy that people own their data and they should be able to use their data the way they want. So there are definitely people, healthcare system is just very backwards. So in the name of privacy, people have put gag orders on, for example, transfer pricing, like insurance price. As you know, consumers are not to know some of the prices between providers and payers, for example. So this is all in the name of privacy and it's all about protecting the consumer. It's utterly against consumers' best interests.
Yeah.
Absolutely, 100%. And it is 100% in consumers' best interest to have their own data, to combine their data the way they want with any other data. And to, but so many people are trying to uphold the silos because of, frankly, it is financially motivated. They want to monetize the data any way that they can. And so we feel very passionately that that healthcare must become consumerized, that people must have choice and they must have a choice of devices they use. They must have choice about who they give their data to, how they combine their data to get insights. Regulations are behind on this.
And your application, is it agnostic in terms of how it's delivered, in terms of what wearable? So you're not a hardware based, you are purely...
We don't believe, yes. It's the old Oracle motto, which is, we are hardware agnostic. We deliver a value on top of hardware and we want consumers to have utter choice about the kind of hardware they use. So we would be committed to adding hardware as we go so people can have their choice.
And so what that means really is that it's very much a software-based application, 100%. Hardware independent,
yes.
which is ideal because then there is no, you don't come up against the sort of the hardware, blocks. Like I don't like that watch. I like this watch.
We don't pick winners. People should have choice.
And can you partner with the likes of, the other companies out there? So are you able to provide your information to them to make their offering more acceptable or more, if you've got existing providers that already have large, large consumer marketplaces, are you likely to want to partner with those guys?
Absolutely. We would love to partner as long as we are not interested in selling our patient data, our user data. We have made the decision that our product is a subscription product that essentially we don't monetize through advertising. Not with, setting that aside, absolutely. We're very much open to partnerships. In fact, we've been heads down on the science and on the research for 3.5 years. We're very interested in monetizing that research and we are very interested in putting it in the hands of, large companies that can bring this to really, really large masses. And we've thought about, I absolutely believe we have the best technology, hands down. I don't know anyone else who has this kind of the approach that we've taken to combining food, CGM, and heart rate data. There are some research that has been done around the world in universities and in some companies with that combination of data, but all of them are small and none of them are predictive in the way that we have made it. Or if they're predictive, they're very encyclopedic. So at the end of the program, they tell you, eat these 10 things, don't eat these 10 things. Oh, wow, big whoopee. I'm at a birthday party. I want to know what I should eat from what's being offered here. What do I do if I'm at the pizzeria? So January is trying to empower you to live in the real world every day with the choices that you face, as opposed to from a given list. So our technology is the best, bar none. We do want to put it in the hands of more people.
And from an advisory perspective, so you're leveraging all of the experiences that you've had, funding obviously is a major part of this. To be able to spend so much time building your fundamental research foundation. But how did you fund this internally, or is this something that you found people very quickly wanted to sort of jump on and support you?
No, I would say that no, we did have a combination of internal and external funds. I think, whenever you start something, I think when I started talking about machine learning and healthcare in 2016, there was a small conference of machine learning and healthcare. That's where I got encouraged to actually go in this direction. But mostly if you came out of the conference and talked to people, including with people like my husband, who had done quite a bit of investments in healthcare. People thought you were crazy. You know, they thought healthcare is never going to change. It's never going to transform.
Well, that's probably
it's
a good sign then, isn't it? You know, you're onto something then.
Yes, you're either actually crazy or you're crazy because you're crazy good. So, but the whole world has come my way. The world has come in, on our way, some for good reasons and some for bad reasons. COVID was a bad reason. The world came our way, but people recognized that they may have underlying conditions that may kill them that or put them at high risk. People got used to telemedicine as a very, very normal thing. So I think telemedicine got, you know, fast forwarded a decade, yes, at least.
Absolutely,
as a result,
yes,
of COVID. You know, I think the healthcare costs, we're spending $3.8 trillion on U.S. healthcare today. That number is supposed to go to 12 trillion, 11.8 trillion by 2040. So I think that we can't afford to continue the way we are. We're just not getting healthier for all the money that we're spending and you know, how to spend $12 trillion on healthcare. So I think we have to go to prevention. So I think there's recognition around that. I think this is the moment for food as medicine. I think people are recognizing that we all are different and that we should be eating differently.
I think you're right. And I think that, you know, COVID has had a big impact. It has completely changed the way that we look at a number of different things, you know, and it has made us much more aware of the possibility that, you know, you can, without a moment's notice, end up with something that's going to kill you. So,
Yeah, but I think that, you know, you have to, you know, I was one of the reasons I started January and could commit ourselves to this journey was that I could self-fund for part of this journey because a lot of people are not in a position to solve big problems. They don't have the mental space to do it. They don't have the financial resources to do it, and they don't care to do it. So if you have the mission, so you're a believer and you want to do something substantial. So my first career was about building great companies and lasting, enduring, profitable, highly profitable companies. Second career was, you know, giving away money and like investing in entrepreneurs and social entrepreneurs. And third career was combining the two. Basically, if you can, essentially, you can have a company that is doing good and is doing well. That's the ultimate. I wanted to just do that one before I die. So that's kind of why I tackled this. So, you know, otherwise, I mean, this is one of the biggest issues we have right now. Where are the world's best and the brightest sitting right now? Where are their talents being applied? To ads. That's where they are. They're sitting at Google and Facebook. That's where they are.
Yeah.
So yes, it was pulling teeth to attract talent to come and work on machine learning and healthcare. That's really, really, really hard. Most of the brilliant people, almost all of the brilliant people that you come across at the time, 4 years ago, they were like, you know, I could work on any interesting problem like autonomous cars and ads and fintech and robotics. And, you know, if you said health, they'd be like, what? Like, how do you even do that? Because people consider it this closed thing. It is. It is a closed thing with awkward incentives and all sorts of archaic rules. One by one, we're chipping away at these rules that people deserve to have their own electronic health records. They should have their own digital health data as well.
Yeah.
That should be absolutely mandated. It is mandated in some laws, but some companies ignore those and they say, no, we sell you a device, but then we're going to monetize the data separately. And that's not really fair to consumers.
I think we could talk, because I just wanted to mention the word blockchain there and the impact of blockchain on healthcare records. But I think that's a whole new conversation, I think, actually. But I just want to stop here for a moment and change direction and leap into the Hooked on Startups quickfire questionnaire.
Okay.
Only because I want to have another podcast with you and talk about all the other amazing stuff.
Sounds good.
But Nasheen, I need to ask you these questions because I feel that the answers that you give will be inspiring to all. So question number one, what is your favorite word?
Commitment.
What is your least favorite word?
Shortcut.
Fantastic. Question three, what are you most excited about right now?
My son's journey in figuring out what his generation, he's 21, should be doing about what's happening on Earth right now.
nothing trivial then. Question four, what turns you off right now?
Extreme left and extreme right. I think people are going mad and it's getting obnoxious and it's affecting companies and affecting everything. Friendships, affecting friendships, families, companies, just conducting governance and running a country. And
I think many people would agree with you there. Question five, what sound or noise do you love?
I have birds chirping by my bedroom in the mornings when I wake up. I must say, sometimes it's unwelcome because I've been up during the night working. But in general, I love birds chirping. I love the sound of water. I also listen to some Persian music. It's really beautiful.
Oh, wow. Yes. And question number six, what sound or noise do you hate?
Sound that I hate. Just repeat sound of air conditioning. It just sounds really boring, but it does. I'm one of those people that, you know, I'm in the 99.9% inventory of like paying attention to details. So what noise can distract me? So I like no noise at all when I'm working.
The white noise becomes.
Yeah, I don't. Definitely don't like the, if there's a annoying air conditioning noise, then I don't like to have it. I love to be 100% focused.
Now, question number seven, and you may plead the fifth. What is your favorite curse word?
Curse word. Well, you know, just the typical. Nothing exciting there.
And that's, I guess there's a panoply of words for the right occasion. Question number eight. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
That I will actually would like to attempt, or that I fantasized about?
Well, either. That, you know, if you could do whatever you wanted, what profession other than your own?
Well, when I was 12 years old, I wanted to be an ambassador. So I think bringing people together would be really, really interesting. That was 12-year-old Nusheen, wanted to be ambassador from Iran to China when I was 12. Whole different story, but I would say something that I probably don't have I definitely don't have the time, and I may not fully have the courage to do is to become a dancer, because that would be crazy. That would be so out of my so out of my comfort zone. It'd be crazy, because mostly I've used my mind, you know, in my life, and I can move mountains with my mind. But dancing, that would be, you know, spending the time to learn, and you'd have to immerse yourself to pick up all
There's
the nuances.
No hiding.
There's no hiding, and then you'd have to be all like, you know, so maybe that a little bit of that is in my future.
How fascinating. And next question, number nine, what profession would you not like to attempt?
I don't think there is one. I wouldn't want to be a lobbyist or, you know, things like that.
Well, they say politics is the art of the possible. Yeah. So my final question then, Nusheen, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
That I did good. That I really do live life that way. Every morning I wake up and I want to have a positive impact on every single person that I meet. I make sure of it. I would like that to happen. I hope that always happens. And if it doesn't happen, I'm sorry. I will make it up on the next person that I meet. But it is foundationally important to me to be a force for good in the world.
Oh, wonderful. Well, Nusheen, my final question is how do people find out more about you, about January, about what you've done, what you're doing?
Thank you. Well, they can go to january.ai. They can also go to thehandfoundation.org. That's W got into foundation. foundation.org. And they could learn about our philanthropic work. So they can also contact me on LinkedIn at Nusheen Hashemi if they have great, brilliant ideas. They're looking for investment. Definitely reach out to our family office. We would love to help.
That's fabulous. Thank you once again for coming on. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, and can't wait to, you know, stay in touch, follow your progress.
Indeed. Thank you so much, Matthew. It was a pleasure to meet you.